Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast. I know there are a lot of options out there, and I'm honored that you think we're worthy of your attention. Here's the thing. Why needs to raise $5,000, and we need your help to do it. At this point, we exist entirely on listener donations, and $5,000 is the minimum amount we need for 1 year of the show. There are fewer places to turn this year than there were last year. Budget cuts are likely to cause layoffs at the University of North Dakota, and small humanities grants are few and far between. We need your help to make ends meet. So please, go to philosophyandpubliclife.org and donate what you can to help us keep making the show. Any amount is welcome, and it's all tax deductible. All of the details are at philosophyandpubliclife.org. Thank you for listening, thank you for donating, and we look forward to hearing your feedback. Please enjoy this month's episode.
Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. On today's show, we're asking the question, how do we talk philosophically about aging with our guest, Sharona Hoffman? The philosopher Martin Heidegger once called people the being unto death. What he meant was that since human beings are aware of our own mortality, living authentically means confronting the fact that we are absolutely, positively going to die. Whether he was right or wrong, I can't say. But his ideas influenced a lot of people. Strangely, though, while philosophers wrote about death, they neglected the getting older part. Aging has been left out of philosophy. Two ideas about age have dominated philosophical thought. First, children are different than adults because adults are rational and morally accountable, and children are neither. Second, our elders should be our mentors because they have more experience, and knowledge is the foundation of wisdom. In other words, aging in philosophy usually implies that we're getting better, not worse. In contrast, there's very little written about the fact that sometimes when we get older, we lose our capacities or we get rigid in our ways. There's a minimal focus on our changing bodies, our degenerating minds, and our faltering independence. Eva Kate, a feminist philosopher and a former guest on our show, has been a powerful advocate for caregivers and dependency, but even she uses mothers caring for children as her central example, not the other way around. Modern life only makes the invisibility of aging worse. In the more developed industrial countries, at least, people are living longer and are no longer part of supportive multi-generational households. The elderly are warehoused in institutions with almost no historical precedent. We're all making up the rules as we go, and from where I sit, we're not doing a good job of it. Group homes and retirement communities in the U.S. are destructively expensive, and according to our guest today, they can be unloving and socially isolating. They're built for efficiency rather than quality of life. They are, in short, part of the bureaucratic American healthcare system and not an integrated component of day-to-day life. Our culture operates on the principle that the only care aging requires is palliative care. This is the foundation upon which we'll approach today's show on the philosophy of aging. The question that I'll come back to again and again is, to what extent should we treat aging as an illness, not as a normal state of affairs? I want to ask not how best to medicate away the effects of old age, but how to confront getting older in an analogous way to Heidegger's demand to confront death as a key element in what gives our actions meaning. In order to do this, though, we have to focus on another one of philosophy's great assumptions, the priority over theory over practice. One of the reasons why philosophers ignoring aging is so prevalent is that they tend to think of the permanent as superior to the ephemeral. This is the legacy of Plato. Fashion is bad because it changes, but beauty is good because it's eternal. Cultural is bad because it is idiosyncratic, but nature is good because it's universal. Aging can be ignored because it describes the frailty of the body, but mortality should be contemplated because it discovers the enduring character of the soul. Yet, underneath it all, we do have fragments of a philosophy of aging. We articulate when old age begins and when it doesn't, even though such a boundary line is kind of arbitrary. We celebrate the virtues of usefulness, glorifying the young and able-bodied, consciously preferring what others can do for us over what we can do for them. We want activity, not calmness, excitement, not slow engagement in the moment. In other words, we want to be reminded of the potential of youth, not the memory of things already done. These are philosophical choices, and they need to be articulated and examined. When it comes to aging, the practice is probably more important than the theory, and this is where our guest comes in. Sharona Hoffman wrote a guidebook to help people plan for their parents and their own futures. It's a practical approach to the task, outlining legal and financial options to help manage a cumbersome and, frankly, frightening process. But like all practical books, it hides deep assumptions about what is valuable and what we take for granted. Our task tonight is to reveal them, to look past the checklists and ask how to conceptualize it all as a whole, so we can change the system and make the most ethical choices for ourselves and for others. Aging is inevitable, but our attitude towards it doesn't have to be. And now our guest. Sharona Hoffman is the Edgar A. Hahn Professor of Law, Professor of Bioethics, and the co-director of the Law Medicine Center at Case Western Reserve University. She's the author of the book Aging with a Plan, How a Little Thought Today Can Vastly Improve Your Tomorrow. This is, by the way, her second time on Why. Sharona, thanks for coming back and talking to us again.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
We're live this evening, so we'd love to have your questions and comments. You can email us at askwhy@und.edu, tweet us at Why Radio Show, or join the conversation on our chat room at philosophyandpubliclife.org. So, Sharona, I guess I should start by admitting that today's episode is a bit of an experiment. Your book is very practical. It has legal information. You may be the first author we've ever had who has a checklist in her book. Financial recommendations, all that sort of stuff. Is it weird to think about this stuff philosophically after spending so much time with such a practical approach?
Not at all. By way of background, the book grew out of a very difficult period in my life. During 18 months in 2013 and 2014, both of my parents died, my mother-in-law died, and my husband was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease at the age of 55. So as I was going through all of this, I was learning a lot about the legal, medical, financial, social, and other challenges of getting older and getting sick and ultimately facing death. Now, I am a professor of law and bioethics, so I knew something about the doctrine and theory of some of these issues, but there's nothing like personal experience to really enliven your knowledge. So the book was my effort, first of all, to find some solutions to problems. Second, to work through my grief in some way. It was therapeutic at many points, but also to engage with the deeper, more philosophical questions that arose, such as how do you parent your parents and still remain respectful and maintain the integrity of that relationship? How do you think about your life when something changes drastically, when your spouse or your partner gets a devastating diagnosis of a degenerative disease? And how do you take all of that and think about your own aging in positive and constructive ways? So there are checklists, but there are also a lot of personal anecdotes in the book, and there is grappling with those more philosophical questions.
Did you find that in such a troubling time that philosophy made things better, or did it just add to the burden? And I'm thinking of Boethius's famous book, The Consolations of Philosophy, and there's a modern version of that as well. There's a sense among many philosophers that, well, Socrates says it best, that philosophy is the process of learning to die. Yet, at the same time, I've often found that philosophy is this incredible monkey on my back, that it doesn't add clarity when I want. So when you're going through such a difficult time, does the tendency that you have, given your history and your training, to think philosophically about things, does it make it harder or does it make it easier?
So often you don't have any time to think about philosophy because things are happening and that's the last thing you should worry about. But there were points, I think, when it helped. So when we had to make decisions, my training helped. I'm, first of all, an ethicist and I'm a member of the ethics committee at University Hospitals. So I knew that we needed to prioritize what was the best interest of our parents, you know, when we had to make decisions about ventilators and things like that. It was helpful to think about, it doesn't matter what we want, we have to do what's in their best interest, and to think about death as the natural end of the journey we have here on Earth.
That's such a complicated phrase. What does best interest mean? I mean, in some sense, we can tell, right, what it means, but it's very complicated. How does someone determine what someone else's best interest is, or frankly, even their own best interest? How do you deal with that as a benchmark?
Right. So the law can actually help sometimes. So in ideal cases, people have actually written up legal documents such as durable powers of attorney for health care or living wills, where they state what they would want at the end of life, or what priorities would they want. Would they want to lengthen life at all costs? Would they want to emphasize quality of life rather than length of life under certain circumstances? You can even state whether you would want a ventilator or artificial nutrition and hydration at the end of life. So ideally, you have some documents that the person has put together when they were mentally capable and long before the crisis occurred that give you some guidance. Other than that, you have to keep in mind that you want to minimize suffering. So if you're not ready to say goodbye to someone, that shouldn't be the driving force. You should think about their comfort, what they would want if they were able to articulate it. How do you minimize suffering?
And again, there's touchstones here on some of the deepest questions, including, frankly, one of the great questions of capitalism. What's the difference between what people want and what their best interest is, right? There are definitely things that I want that aren't in my best interest. Suppose someone writes something in one of these documents and you think, yes, this is clearly what they wanted, but they were wrong to want it. How do you approach something like that?
Well, thankfully, we do have a little bit of legal guidance. And if the document was really written by them when they were decisionally capable, that should be the final word on it. So you're not, a child is not able to say my parent was wrong when they wrote this if the document is valid and legal. It does cause conflicts, though, in families very often, where some people think this is perfectly reasonable, other people think this is absolutely unreasonable, or it's unreasonable under the circumstances. The loved one said, I would never want a ventilator, and yet the doctors are saying, well, we could put them on a ventilator for a week, and then they'll survive and have a good quality of life. So there are instances when there is tremendous conflict and you think, oh boy, the person just didn't think about these particular circumstances, didn't anticipate them when they articulated their desires. So it can be a very complex question.
You know, when my grandfather died suddenly, my grandmother, who was not the easiest woman when she was alive, sat at his bedside and we were having this conversation about whether to keep him on the ventilator. And she looked, and in this, it's almost completely out of character tone of voice and attitude, she said, no husband of mine is going to live attached to a machine. And this is one of my most vivid memories of a person rising to the occasion. And I wonder, how often does the worst bring out the best? How often does the stress bring out the virtue in people as opposed to the selfishness that is often glorified in soap operas and novels?
I do not have a percentage breakdown of that, unfortunately.
But just your instinct, your sense. I mean, at least in part, right, part of what your life is focused on is this tension between the law and ethics. And our listeners know, and of course you know very well, that just because something legal doesn't mean it's moral, and just because something is moral doesn't mean that it should be legal or illegal. And do you have a sense, though, that end-of-life issues, that aging can have a constructive effect on people in this sense? Or is it just – it's just crisis management and people are what they are? I'm thinking of the short story A Good Man Is Hard to Find, where this woman is faced with robbers, and someone said about her at the end, she would have been a good woman if someone had pointed a gun at her for her entire life, right? This sense that human beings under stress and human beings under great situations, we like to think it brings out the best. Do you have any sense at all that there is a trend, or is it entirely idiosyncratic and some people do well and some people do poorly?
I would say the latter. There are people who do very well under stress. I constantly admire my husband, who is living with a Parkinson's disease diagnosis and handling it, I think, much better than I would. He's really learned to live day to day, not to worry too much about the future. I, who wrote a book called Aging with a Plan, would probably be trying to plan every minute and would be extremely stressed out. But in other cases, and again, I see it as a member of an ethics committee at a hospital, it does terrible things to families. All the tensions that they've had, everything in their backgrounds comes out in the worst way. They can't agree on anything. They cause terrible stress to the patient, arguing in front of the patient, making it very difficult for the doctors to treat. So it's just very individualized, and you can't necessarily anticipate before these things happen how people will react or behave.
So the implication of this is that planning and having these documents and all of the things that you talk about in your book will help ease the stress and help mitigate the horribleness that, in fact, anticipating what will happen could make people both better people as well as better decision makers.
Absolutely. Doing some thinking, doing some planning, and generating the legal documents that provide instructions to your loved ones and to the doctors can be very, very helpful. They can eliminate conflicts. They can provide relief to family members who don't have to make things up from scratch and make very important decisions with no guidance in the middle of a crisis. And so it's all designed to try to make the experience less traumatic and smoother for everyone.
So I wonder, again, a philosophical question. What does it mean to be old? The book is called Aging with a Plan, and I think of some people who seem very youthful at very old ages and other people who seem very old at very young ages. Is there any sense, do you as a bioethicist, do you as someone on this committee, do you as someone who has struggled with this as a person, have any sense of what it means to be old? I don't want to ask you how old, 62 and a half, 84 and three quarters, right? I don't want to ask you for it. We're not doing casuistry, right? But what makes a person old and what makes a person young?
Well, certainly in our society, we think of 65 as some sort of a cutoff in terms of Medicare, in terms of retirement age. At least until recently, I think you become Social Security eligible at 67 if you're my age. So 65 does seem to be at least a symbolic cutoff, but you're absolutely right that a lot of it is a matter of attitude and behavior. And certainly as I age, I thought after 50, I would feel very, very different. And you really don't. You still feel like the same person. So a lot of people will tell you that the biological age doesn't make as much of a difference as they thought it would. So there are certainly some biological indicators, there is age, but a lot of it is attitude.
Is there a sense when the ethics committee meets, for example, or when you talk to other philosophically minded people about this, that the category between old and young has a radical separation, a bifurcation, that you're either old or you're young, and people treat the older people differently simply because they consider them old, and people treat younger people differently because they consider themselves young? Are these distinct categories, or are they just legal shortcuts and based on arbitrary statutes?
I don't think so. Certainly in the ethics context, what we worry about is the person decisionally incapacitated, or are they capable of making their own decisions? And that's the important distinction. And some people can make decisions until the day they die, and other people, because of mental illness or traumatic brain injuries or whatever, stop being able to make their decisions at a very young age or are never capable of making those decisions. And so I don't think we think of a particular point at which you become old. It is interesting, though, that as medical technology has made it possible to live longer and longer, society has actually become much more youth-obsessed, and we don't in our society look forward to aging or necessarily look up to older people as wiser, as teachers, and so on. We rather have developed industries that are meant to make you never look old, to take away your wrinkles, take away your gray hair. And so I think society is not nearly as respectful of older people as we might be, given how much we have lengthened people's lifespan.
How much do you think is that a product of the separating of the old from the young, of the, you know, as I said in the monologue, the warehousing, the non-multi-generational households that we visit our parents, we visit our grandparents, that's very compartmentalized? Do you think that if we interacted more deeply on a day-to-day basis, that we wouldn't be so youth-obsessed?
Probably not. And I'm not sure I agree that we warehouse them. In fact, one of the major problems that we have, at least in American society, is that many people can't afford to go to nursing homes or to go to assisted living or to go to nice facilities such as continuing care retirement communities, because health insurance doesn't pay for that. And if you have to go to a nursing home and you want the government to pay, you have to completely impoverish yourself and become Medicaid eligible. And so what happens more often, I think, is people age in place. They stay in the homes that they've had, which are paid off, and then they potentially become socially isolated, which is problematic. You are right that we don't have very many multi-generational households, so we don't have very many children growing up with grandparents living in their very own homes. But I'm not sure that we simply put people away in institutions, even when they could really benefit from being in a community setting or in a more social setting.
You know, you've anticipated exactly the two questions that I was going to ask you after the break. The first is elder care a luxury for the wealthy? And the second is, what does an ideal elder care community look like? So why don't you think about those two questions as we take a break, and we'll come back and we'll dive more into this question of how we should think philosophically about the aging. You're listening to Sharona Hoffman and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Sharona Hoffman about the philosophizing about aging and talking about her book, How to Aging with a Plan. I'm sorry, Sharona. The book was right in front of me and I've lost the title. Here it is. Aging with a Plan, How a Little Thought Today Can Vastly Improve Your Tomorrow. It's obviously available on Amazon. It's a book oriented for the general public. And as I was reading it and as I was thinking about today's show, I had two very vivid memories. The first was of my grandmother on my father's side, my bubby, who had Alzheimer's disease and had moved from her apartment where she lived until she was about 80 into her sister's apartment. And I was 15 and I wanted my ears pierced, and my father told me that I couldn't get my ears pierced. So of course I went out and got my ears pierced. And my father said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go to your grandmother and she's going to read you the Riot Act. And so we went and to visit her at my aunt's house, and he pulls my ear over and he says, Ma, look at what he did. And very slowly and very deliberately, she took her hand and she put it behind my ear and she said, oh, is this the style right now? I should get my earrings out of my box. Now, this was one of the great victories against my father, of course, but it was a very vivid sense of how my Bubby reacted to the world despite the fact that she was struggling with her own cognition. And then on the flip side, I have this memory of my best friend Gail's father. I mentioned Gail a lot on the show. Her father, Charlie, who as he got older, had to have a boarder in his house and had a young woman in her 20s living in the spare room. And he started watching cartoons with her and playing video games and had this great year or two together where they would do all this stuff, and he was just this young, vibrant guy. And then without any notice, he passed away in his sleep one night. He had a drink, went to sleep, and never woke up, which from his perspective is probably the best way to die, although it was brutal for Gail and her family and, of course, for me and everyone who loved him. This sense that in the right circumstances, being old can be a youthful adventure is both what we want and what we don't know how to give people. So all of that is to say, Sharona, in your research, have you come to any decisions as to what an ideal elder community would look like? Is there something that would be generally preferable to all people if they had the money? Or is this yet just a matter of personal preference?
Well, I'm a big fan of continuing care retirement communities, which are very, very costly, unfortunately. But I've visited quite a number, and the good ones have a tremendous sense of community. They offer social opportunities. They offer educational programs. They offer transportation so people don't have to drive. Some of them enable people to take college courses. One of them had a daycare center for small children there so that the older people could interact with young children. They are rich with opportunity. And continuing care retirement communities have several levels of care on the same campus. So you get independent living, assisted living, and nursing homes all on the same campus. So as your needs become more intensive, you don't have to leave the community. You just move to another part of it. Your friends can visit you. Your spouse can visit you on a daily basis. And you can continue to interact with the same staff and not have the trauma of moving from place to place. So a theme that runs throughout the book is the importance of social interaction. And I'm a firm believer in that. Social interaction has been shown to be connected to good mental health, good physical health, and even longevity. And loneliness is connected, by contrast, to a lot of physical problems, worse cardiovascular problems, higher blood pressure, more insomnia. So I think that people need to be very aware that they have to avoid social isolation. And this trend of aging in place, it can be great for people if they still have social opportunities, but it can be very, very isolating for people. And I often urge people to think about community settings, if there's a risk of social isolation.
How do you, this is a practical question, but again, it has philosophical roots. How do you convince people who are resistant to these sorts of decisions to do what is best for them, social interaction, right? I can imagine a circumstance where an individual or a couple live in their own home, their friends are dying, they don't want to get out and do things even though they're capable of doing things, and their kids, by pressuring them, are perceived as disrespecting them, as not letting them make their own decisions, as just invading their space. How can you present this, your research as an ideal research, without insulting the person you're trying to persuade?
That's a big challenge, and not only in this area. I have a chapter on driving, and
right,
that's even more sensitive. And so I think one thing to do is simply emphasize that you are talking to your loved ones about these issues because you love them and you have their best interest in mind. A lot of retirement communities will enable people to come and live there for a couple of days without making any commitment at all. So you can say,
you actually mention, I'm sorry to interrupt, you actually mentioned in the book some people you know who take a week's vacation every year to a different retirement community just to see what that was like. And I thought that was a brilliant idea, albeit recognizing a cloud over their lives, but trying it out. I never had the sense before reading the book that you could try these things out first.
Absolutely. And I talk to a lot of older people who have done that. And some communities will even let you live there for a month if you'd like, if they have some vacant residencies. So, you know, treading gently, not saying, Mom and Dad, you've got to leave this house within a month and move somewhere. That is not a great approach. But if you speak out of love, you explain that it's out of concern, and you give them as much autonomy and independence as possible, just suggest go visit a couple of places. I think that makes things much easier.
How about, and again, this is a very practical question, but how about something like access to your parents' passwords, right? I mean, any one of us now has email, bank accounts, credit card accounts, social network accounts, all of these things that if someone were to die or become incapacitated, life would be infinitely easier if somewhere there was a list of all of their passwords and usernames. On the other hand, we're discouraged from having that list. So how do you respect people's autonomy while preparing for the inevitable?
Yes. So if your parents are willing to give you a list of all their passwords and they write them down correctly, that's another problem.
Right.
That's helpful. Unfortunately, passwords also change all the time. So that's a complicating factor. Every time I think I know all of mine, you know, I'm told I have to change them and make them more secure. So one solution is to, again, a legal document. It's amazing how much the law can help in this area. There's a legal document called A Durable Power of Attorney for Finances and Property, which again names a decision maker. So your parents can name you or someone else as a decision maker. And then if they become decisionally incapacitated, if you have that document, you can go to the banks with it And once the banks verify that the parent is in fact decisionally incapacitated, it usually takes a letter from the doctor, they will open the accounts to you so that you can still write checks, that you can make financial decisions about the accounts or about property. Maybe you have to sell something in order to pay for your parents' care. So having the legal documents can allow you to circumvent the need for all of those passwords.
I want to ask a version of the same question in a different context and ask how your experience of this changed when it was about yourself as opposed to other people. You're very forthcoming in the book, both about your experience with your parents and with your husband, but also that aging is a particular issue for you because neither you nor your husband have children. And so there isn't that next generation who's presumed to care for you, although that's a presumption that often is not realized. Does this stuff have more meaning or less meaning when you're doing it for yourself? Is it depressing? Did you change your behaviors and your plans from doing this research? How much does the assumptions of all of this shift when you're no longer talking about someone else, but you're talking about your own aging?
It is a little bit scarier, but it's very much in my mind that we don't have children, and so there's not going to be anyone who's going to drop everything and rush to our aid when we need it. And so I have tried very hard, first of all, to save as much money as possible so that we can hire help when we need it, so that maybe we can move to a nice retirement community when the house is not a good fit for us anymore. And I've been very careful to have all of the legal documents that name siblings as decision makers. Happily, I'm the oldest of my siblings, so I'm hoping they're in better shape than I am later on. I've named decision makers. I've made sure that I have a will. I've thought a lot about what I've wanted. And by the way, it's not enough to just have documents. You also have to have repeated conversations with your decision makers so that they're aware of your philosophy of end of life. What would you want? What would you want to prioritize? Do you have religious beliefs that might inform your decisions? So I've had a lot of conversations with people, and then you just have to hope for the best.
We've spent a lot of time talking about end-of-life issues and about degenerative issues. In your work, did you develop a philosophy of old age that is distinct from the medical necessity, that is distinct from the limitations that age puts on you? What does a vibrant old age look like? What is a... In the words of the Greeks, what is an excellent old age? What should that be?
Well, I will come back to my theme. And so, first of all, it needs to be a time in your life where you remain socially active, where you have friendships, where you go out, where you volunteer, where you continue to learn, where you continue to feel connected to others and to feel that your life is meaningful. So, I have a friend who's a geriatric social worker, and she tells me that you have to remain physically, intellectually, and socially active until the very end. And I try to keep that in mind. That is very much part of my philosophy. And so, again, I hope that I myself will someday be able to retire, but remain active, volunteer, continue to take courses, and continue to socialize.
What does volunteering mean in the context of a vocation as opposed to a job? And I'll be quite explicit what I mean by this. Both my parents have decided to retire from their artistic endeavors. My father is a musician who whose music we hear on the radio show every month. My mother is a very well-regarded visual artist with 60-some-odd years of painting and installation works. And both of them have decided that it's time to stop. Even though my mother retired from her teaching profession quite a while ago. Are you suggesting that perhaps that's not the best thing to do? That if you have a vocation as opposed to employment, if you have something that is meaningful to you, that you should keep it going as long as you possibly can? Or does getting older mean recognizing that there is a fundamental shift in how you spend your day?
Again, that is very, very individualized. So I know people who were biochemistry professors, and they always liked to paint. And now they are painters who actually exhibit their work. I have a relative who was an architect, but he always loved photography. And now in his 90s, he exhibits his photographs all over the city. And so he has shifted, but he is still doing work that is very creative and very meaningful, and really enjoying having the freedom to do that as much as he wants without having to attend to a 9-to-5 job. Others continue in their line of work. They volunteer as teachers. If they were teachers, they volunteer at the hospitals. If they were medical professionals. So it's whatever it is that's going to make you happy and you feel vibrant.
We have it at various different times faced questions that had no answer, difficult answers, and you've gone back to legal examples of helpful things. As you investigate aging, is the law a comfort to you, or did you find the law to be lacking and inadequate in what you wanted for yourself and for the people you love?
It's really both. So the legal documents that we've mentioned, a living will, a healthcare power, durable healthcare power of attorney, documents like that, are very comforting because they provide instructions that are supposed to bind doctors. They allow you to name a decision maker who will take over decisions. And so doing those things provides me with some comfort that my wishes will be followed later on. But there are a lot of areas where there are gaps in the law that are quite troubling. So a lot of people can't afford long-term care because health insurance doesn't cover it. And there aren't government programs in this country that take over. You can have long-term care insurance, but that is extremely expensive, and only a small fraction of people are able to purchase that. It's often a bad idea to purchase it, in fact. When it comes to driving, the government doesn't do enough to identify drivers that are at risk or take driver's licenses away, so it's up to the family to have to intervene. And there are a lot of drivers out there that shouldn't be driving anymore, but they're on the road. So there are a lot of areas where there are gaps in regulation, gaps in government programs and laws.
This is a non sequitur, but we just got an email question from Sam in Grand Forks, and it's a really good question. I wonder if you have any thoughts on this. How much, he wants to know, of our attitude about aging is about things that make us uncomfortable, or things that we regard as disturbing culturally, like material or bodily decay or uncleanliness or things like that. How much does aging represent the part of our cultural life that we try to clean up?
I think some people do think of aging as a form of decay, but it really doesn't need to be that way. I mean, we could think of older people as beautiful, of wrinkles as showing a life well lived. And so a lot of it is attitude. Now, one of the things that is very frightening, of course, is dementia, the Alzheimer's statistics. In 2012, we had 5.4 million people who were living with Alzheimer's. And as people live longer and longer and longer, you see more and more people with dementia. And I think that does affect how we look at the elderly.
And this, I think, is the core of the philosophical question, right? How do we look at aging as something beautiful? Is it possible to shift our cultural attitudes and look at the lines of a person's face as glorious, as character, as representations of all the things that human beings can do in spite of their frailty? And so I guess as we're running out of time, I would ask, did your research affect how you felt about aging philosophically? Do you have a sense that you are more or less respectful of the aged as people than you were when you started this book?
I'm not sure I was ever disrespectful.
I didn't mean to
imply aged.
Right?
Yeah. It certainly made me less frightened of aging. First of all, I spent a lot of time with people, hearing their stories, talking to them about their experience, visiting nice retirement communities. And so it showed me that there can be a lot to look forward to, that people actually can have a very good time in the last decades of their life, and that you just have to do the work to save some money, make sure you have your documents in place in case something happens, and think about how to have a life that is social and creative and purposeful throughout. And then it's possible to actually do that. Part of the problem is that we don't want to think about aging. We don't want to think beyond when we're able to work and live a very, very vigorous life. But that's not the best approach.
Do you think that, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question, do you think that where should we look for the cultural tools to help us be positive about the aging process? Again, is this a matter of law, or is this a matter of philosophy? Is it a matter of literature? What would you call, if someone came up to you and said, Sharona, you're an expert on this, I want to feel good about my future, what would you suggest to them to help develop this philosophical attitude that aging is a plus, not a minus?
First of all, I think you should spend more time with people who are older. And as you've pointed out, because we often don't live with grandparents or older people, it's not always easy. And so spending some time with people, seeing how they live, hearing their stories is helpful. And then we do have a way to go in terms of supporting the elderly. And so talking to legislators or becoming active in your community in order to make sure that there is adequate transportation for elderly people who can't or shouldn't be driving. We have a terrible shortage of geriatricians who can take care of the elderly and coordinate their care. So lobbying for more support for medical students who want to go into less lucrative specialties such as geriatrics is useful. So there are a lot of things that we can do as a society to make it a little bit easier, and they are worth doing. By 2030, we'll have 72 million seniors in this country, and we're going to have to face the fact that they're going to have some challenges and that we're going to have to provide more support. So it's a combination of spending time with people and lobbying for sufficient social programs so that it doesn't seem like a time that is desolate or problematic.
We just got an email from John, who is an anatomy professor, actually, and he said that he knows of long-term studies that suggest that doctors who weren't, and he said, creeped out, for lack of a better term, by older people and the physical signs of aging, themselves live longer and healthier lives than their counterparts who were made uncomfortable by the aging process. How much do you think our attitudes about aging helps determine what we are going to be like when we get older?
Well, I think certainly if you are very negative about it and you're going to become depressed or become unable to handle what challenges you face, you are not going to thrive as much. So if you live in dread of aging, of whatever deterioration in appearance or in vigor that you're going to experience, you're not going to do as well.
When my wife Kim and I first came to UND and we were setting up a retirement plan with TIAA CREF, the person asked us, well, when do you plan on retiring? And Kim said, about 60. And I said, about 80. we both burst out laughing, and I think we both met somewhere in the middle. But there is that sense that part of what defines what you want aging to be is how useful you can anticipate yourself being, right? You spent a fair amount of time talking about people needing to feel useful. What does that mean? What does it mean to feel useful, and what does it mean to take that sense of usefulness away from someone who's growing older?
Right. It's very much tied to the idea of remaining socially active. So feeling useful means doing things that are helpful to others most of the time. So volunteering in whatever capacity, doing work that may or may not be along the lines of what your career was. So becoming an artist if you haven't been an artist, or volunteering at a hospital, or continuing to learn, that can make you feel useful as well, because you are expanding or improving yourself in some way. So there are a lot of different opportunities, but the primary thing is not to sit home alone and watch television and feel that you're not connected to anyone and no one cares about you.
Is this an instance of inside baseball comment here? Is this an instance of the Kantian notion of autonomy gone awry? And what I mean by that for our listeners is, since the 18th century, since Kant became really the foundation of contemporary ethics and political philosophy, there's been this notion that a person should be an autonomous agent. They should be individual, and they should take care of themselves, right? And that if you are dependent on someone else, you're somehow not a fully ethical agent. You're not a fully ethical person. And so is part of this that we just have to get past this notion of autonomy, or is part of it that our definition of autonomy itself, of what it means to be an individual, has to change throughout our whole lives, not just when we're older?
I think for a lot of elderly, the concept of autonomy, which kept them going and served them extremely well for many decades, they simply take it too far. And I'm thinking of my mother-in-law, who was widowed at a very young age, in her 30s, I believe, and raised three children on her own and lived on her own and was financially independent. And she was just a real fighter and extremely autonomous. But she carried that into her 90s and refused to leave her home, even when she couldn't get around, even when she was in terrible pain, which turned out to be cancer. And she really did a lot of suffering in the last few years of her life, which she didn't need to endure. Had she moved closer to us, to where her children were, had she moved into a retirement community where many more of her needs would be served, she would have had a much better quality of life. And so autonomy, which served her so well for so many decades, really backfired at the end there.
Do you think that it's just hard to reverse course in characterologically, or do you think that she just wasn't aware of her best interests?
It's very hard to reverse course. Again, there are cost concerns, which were very much a priority for her. She really wanted to leave money for her children. She didn't want to spend it on a nursing home. And because health insurance does not cover long-term care, a lot of people who've defined themselves in some way as people who are leaving an inheritance for their children are just devastated by the notion that they might have to turn it over to caregivers. And I know if you have one home care aide living with you full time, that can cost $175,000 a year. And even a nursing home, a not great nursing home, can cost $80,000 a year. So that is a big problem, the cost, the wanting to do what you've always planned to do, which is not spend your own money.
I'm just processing what you just said. I mean, obviously, some of these figures are in the book, but it's incredibly expensive to be old. And yet, for most people, that's the time when they have the least amount of money or access to liquidity in their adult life.
That is correct. You start working, you start living on a fixed income. You're not bringing in earnings anymore. And so long as you don't need any help and you're living independently, your costs may be quite limited. If you're still living in the home, it may be paid off. I gave a talk and spoke to a woman who said she actually very much wants to move to a retirement community, but her financial advisor keeps telling her, don't you dare. Your utilities and taxes cost $300 a month, and you need to keep that cost and not take on any more costs. So that's a huge challenge.
We know a couple who now in their 80s, who it is infinitely more expensive to downsize than it is to live in their big house. That their big house is too hard to clean, the lawn is too hard to take care of, but it costs much more money to move to a condo with no lawn than it is to pay a lawn service to help them. And I think that's a very common experience, right?
Yes, yes, certainly. Having to move somewhere else where you're going to start paying rent, where you're going to start paying a mortgage, is very daunting for a lot of people.
I have this thing nagging in the back of my head, and it hasn't yet created the question yet, but I teach Intro to Ethics using films quite frequently. And because they're college students, I spend a lot of time talking about sexual ethics. And one of the films that I show, well, let me tell the story in the right way. And the students, being college students, are incredibly open-minded. They no longer care about gay marriage. They no longer are bothered by people with multiple partners. There's some flexibility in terms of open marriages, although most of them are fairly romantic in terms of monogamous relationships. And they pride themselves on a certain kind of sexual sophistication. So then in the midst of all these movies, I show them the movie Harold and Maude. And Harold and Maude is one of, as far as I know, I think one of the great movies, and certainly one of the great movies about aging, and it's also a Holocaust film. And in the film, I don't know if you've seen it or how long ago you've seen it, there's an older woman who is just about to turn 80, and she ends up having a relationship with this guy who's in his early 20s. And in a key moment, they end up having sex. And the students freak out. The students find this to be the most shocking thing that we discuss all semester. And even though the male character is about 22 years old, every semester I get at least one or two students who call Maude a pedophile. I'm trying to find the question that doesn't revert back to the creepiness question that we had over email. And I guess it's as follows. Is it possible to regard – no, I don't want to say is it possible. That's the wrong way to ask this question. In your research, did you find that people stripped away the wholeness of the elderly and therefore stopped treating them like whole human beings, like true human beings? Maude is 80. She still has a sexuality. And we know from lots of different news reports that, in fact, older communities are many older people are quite promiscuous, that there is sex life after 65, after 75, and so on. And how much do people strip away the fullness of the elderly in an attempt to disregard them so that they can be managed? I know that's a really ambiguous question, but I'm not entirely sure how to frame it.
I think that that is a phenomenon, and we certainly sometimes think of the elderly as infants and speak to them as infants, even though we have absolutely no idea what their cognitive capacity is like. I've seen many times, you know, you have an elderly person in a wheelchair and she's approached and spoken to like a child, even though the speaker has no idea whether she's lucid or sharp or whatever. And so there is that tendency sometimes to see people who look very elderly as not complete human beings, as being incapacitated in some way, and surely that extends to sexuality.
It's not, I mean, obviously I use sexuality as an example, but it's not how, as you were doing your research, did you find that the institutions themselves were part of the culprits for how we think about the elderly, that the way that we expect them to live, the way that we set up ideals for them or for ourselves when we get older, that even if people were themselves incredibly open and generous to everyone they met, that the institutions necessitated a certain kind of interaction between those who are in a retirement community or in a nursing home or in assisted living and those who are not?
That depends on the institution. So one reason continuing care retirement communities or the better independent living communities are great is because they're very sensitive to the social and intellectual needs of the residents, and they have a lot of programming. They have professors coming to speak. I've gone to speak at some of these communities. They have fitness classes. They have transportation to museums and cultural events. And so those kind of communities are great. Some of the nursing homes are not. The food is terrible because perhaps they assume that, well, elderly people don't have good taste buds anymore. My mother-in-law had to spend some time in a nursing home after an injury, and she said they advertised programming, but it was like artwork for six-year-olds. It was not at all intellectually or otherwise challenging. And so it really depends on the quality of the institution, which is why it's important to do research, to start the project of finding a community before you're in crisis, before you have to move because you've had a hip fracture or some other major injury. And they really differ from one to the other.
How do you feel? You mentioned this in passing in the book, and you actually mentioned it earlier on the show. And I have often felt that having a retirement community on a college campus and having a childcare community on a college campus would be beneficial for everybody, including the students who are creeped out by Harold and Maude, although I'm not sure that they ought to cross date. Is integration of different age groups ultimately healthy, or rather, that's a leading question. Does the dangers of the lack of the controlled environment outweigh the health of the integrated lifestyle?
I think it's very, very important to integrate. And in fact, there is a trend. I believe there are 50 or so continuing care retirement communities that are deliberately placed on or near college campuses, because that provides great opportunities for everyone. The residents can take classes, which keeps them intellectually engaged. They can help. They can volunteer, either teaching courses or tutoring students who are having some academic problems. And it allows the students to volunteer and to come in contact with older people. And sometimes they use the retirement community as a place to practice for musical performances or drama performances, and that benefits everyone. And it also makes aging less scary, because they've interacted when they've been very young, they've befriended people, they've seen that they have satisfying lives. So that's a great solution.
But then again, there's this problem of control. So much of what we're talking about is trying to control the world around us. And we can't control it all, but we can control some things. So again, sort of, I'm just pushing the question. A college campus is a place that isn't as safe, although it's certainly a lot safer than, say, Times Square, right? How much does a person need to sacrifice the quality of life versus the control of life, for lack of a better term?
Why do you say that they're not safe?
I'm trying to make this out in my head, right? There's a old age home that we visit quite often here. A lot of the kids have their piano performances. Our daughter does, and there was yoga classes there. And the hallways are wide, and there are railings in the hallways, and the elevators are big for wheelchairs, and there's a softness about the furniture for people who have trouble moving around. And of course, college campuses don't have those sorts of things. So is a nursing home designed for the most frail of people, and therefore there are lots of things that people don't need as they walk around in life? Or does there have to be, in a environment, different controls to prevent people from breaking their hips, from fracturing their hips, as you just said? And a college campus doesn't have those sorts of things. So there are people who, when they plan for retirement or plan for old age, they're planning for as much as they can control as possible. And so I guess what I'm trying to get at is the basic philosophical question of, how much do you sacrifice freedom for security? How much do you sacrifice the intellectual possibilities and programming and social possibilities for the health risks?
Well, I'm not sure that there's necessarily a conflict, because you would still have the facility. You would have a building that is completely accessible and has all of those safeguards that you mentioned. And the people who are not too frail would be able to go out into classrooms and other buildings, which they can in any environment, because they can have somebody drive them, and they do, to medical facilities or the theater or wherever, or shopping malls, which are less safe. And some people would be frail and not be able to leave the facility that often, but they would be able to have college students come and do the piano recitals and do the performances and interact with them and maybe get some tutoring and so on. And so the facilities that I'm thinking of are sort of have the best of all worlds, because they have the safety, and yet very close by there are facilities that might be slightly less safe but provide opportunities for those who are robust enough to take advantage of them.
So really we've come to the point where we have to insist, as we often do in any group-oriented discussion, whether we're talking about what it means to be Jewish or what it means to be African-American or what it means to be a man or a woman, that aging is not just one thing, that aging is a spectrum of things. And what you're trying to do is give people the opportunity to choose the environment that gives them the most freedom to be whatever it is they end up being.
Absolutely.
What then, as we wrap up, would you recommend people do to start planning, and when? Should a 30-year-old be thinking about this? Should a 50-year-old be thinking about it? What are the first steps besides, for, of course, buying your book on Amazon, right? What are the first steps to thinking seriously about aging in a responsible way that involves also taking a census of your attitudes about aging? How does one start?
Right. So, yes, buying a book first, buying the book first and foremost, that's of great importance. But I think having the legal documents done is extremely important. If you have children, you want to have a will. You never know when something catastrophic will happen. So having a decision maker, having some instructions for what medical care you would and wouldn't want, is that can and should be done at any age. Saving for retirement. A lot of people don't do that until it's too late. And in fact, the experts will tell you, if you have a choice between saving for your children's college education and saving for retirement, you should absolutely choose saving for retirement, because your child can get student loans, and for retirement you can't get any loans. And so thinking about building a nest egg and preparing financially for retirement, that too should be done really as soon as you start working. And then I have a chapter on medical care, and so learning to become an active member of your own medical team is very important, again, at any age. Learning that you need to ask questions, that you need to research your conditions, you need to have support systems, don't go to the doctor by yourself. If it's an important appointment, don't go to the hospital or procedures by yourself. So there's a lot that you can learn about medical care, which is relevant at any age. But really, in your 40s and 50s, you need to make sure that you've taken these steps because it's getting closer. And you never know when you're going to have to care for older loved ones. So being educated about these issues so you can have conversations with loved ones when challenges come up is very important.
And of course, my wife and I wrote wills almost immediately after our daughter was born. And there's that other side of it, right, that in addition to caring for yourselves, you're caring for the people who are caring for you.
Correct. It is no kindness to have not thought about things, funeral instructions, for example. People tell me, I don't want to be demanding. I don't want to give my children instructions about what to do. They should do whatever they want. That is a terrible thing to do to your children, because they're going to be traumatized. The last thing they want is to have to plan from scratch and figure out what you would want, how they can honor you. So providing instructions about anything and everything is really going to make it much, much easier for your family members.
I think that's a great point. I think about when someone dies or there's some great trauma, that people bring over food. And if you aren't with it enough to make a meal, you're certainly not with enough to make long-standing, impactful decisions like, how do I want to honor my parents?
Correct.
Well, Sharona, this has been very interesting, and it's always incredibly exciting to have one foot in the theory and one foot in the practice and see what kind of practical conversation we're going to have and what kind of philosophical conversation we're going to have and which way the wind blows. So thank you so much for joining us on Why.
My pleasure. It's been a great experience.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Sharona Hoffman talking about thinking philosophically about aging, and we've been talking about the book Aging with a Plan, How a Little Thought Today Can Vastly Improve Your Tomorrow, and we'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions in Every Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We were talking with Sharona Hoffman about aging with a plan and how we can think philosophically about aging. And something happened at the very end, which I really hadn't occurred to me until it happened, which was our guest, Sharona, used the word seniors. We had not used the term senior citizens once in the entire discussion that I noticed anyway. We had not used the term that is the preferred polite form of talking about or addressing the elderly. And in a culture that is obsessed with words, black instead of African American, gay instead of homosexual, it's odd that Sharona and I were both very comfortable using a variety of terms, or maybe it was just me and I was not properly prepared. Either way, the words we use help us talk about things philosophically. And so I just want to suggest that one of the ways that you can think philosophically about aging is to not worry about the semantics of the issue and dive right in, but do it respectfully. If you're thinking about it yourself, do it with all the honesty you can. But if you're doing it with a partner, if you're doing it with someone you care about, if you're planning these tasks with your parents or with a spouse or with someone else who you will care for or who you want to care for you, figure out how to treat them as a person, not a problem, and investigate your philosophical assumptions about aging, because how you feel about aging is going to dictate how you feel about planning for aging. And then if you plan for aging successfully, you may end up feeling better about the aging process itself. You've been listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. As always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album, Lua e Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.